Okay, so we're on day six now, and mind you how the schedule is, we have homeworks 4 through 7 are due on day 9, so it would be Thursday next week. And let's see, I wrote it down, yes. Today's homework is exercise 18. I think it's all 1.3.3. No, fourth subsection. So, last time, talked about what functions are considered measurable. This time, we'll talk about, okay, if a function is measurable, what is its integral? So, in your own reading, is there anything you wanted to ask me about?
Complex numbers for the last lecture was heard to extend to the complex field.
It's very helpful for a lot of applications. Have you heard of the Fourier transform?
Yes.
Fourier transform, quantum mechanics. I mean, complex numbers just are very useful, and so it's standard to extend the theory to handle the complex part. But it's pretty easy at this stage because all you're doing is saying, okay, integrate the real part, integrate the imaginary part. You just do everything twice. If you start doing some real work with it, when you're actually doing Fourier transforms, then you actually start to notice, oh yeah, there's some complex numbers here, not just a pairs of real numbers. I've got to find the eraser. Interesting, if I don't find the eraser. I left a bunch of glue behind. That's not very helpful. Sometimes you get left behind another board, but all right. Well, fail to find an eraser. I'll just okay, good. Okay. So, here we are. definition, measurability. Is that your function is a pointwise limit of simple functions. So each of these is a linear combination of indicator functions. And the coefficients are from 0 to infinity, and the sets being indicated are Lebesgue measurable. So real quick, that's what we got. Now in this setup, the convergence is almost everywhere pointwise, meaning there could be a set of Lebesgue measure zero on which you do not have pointwise convergence. This time, the coefficients can be complex, but they can't be infinity. So what do we need? And these sets all need to have finite measure. They need to be measurable, and the measure needs to be finite. So that means outside of some finite union of sets of finite measure, so outside of some set of finite measure, these functions are zero, right? Whereas here, you might have a set of infinite measure on which the function is some non-zero value. If you do, of course, then you're going to have a rectangle of infinite area. Okay, so this is... So we have the unsigned, and then we have the complex valued. So in the associated integral, is given by, it's basically what you think of as a lower Darboux integral, but now a lower integral, lower Lebesgue integral, as you could call it. So you just take the supremum of all these kinds of functions, right? Summarize this as So you just take, just add up the areas of all the rectangles. So you have some kind of finite sum of this form. I don't need quite as many subscripts this time, so. Something like that. At all the unsigned simple underestimates of F. Just as in the lower Darboux integral, you looked at step function underestimates of F, right? Functions that were piecewise constant. Tau calls them step functions. And now, for the complex-valued integral, we're not going to define it for every measurable complex-valued function, only for ones where there's no worries about infinity.
Right. I mean,
these, all of these kind of simple functions here would all naturally have corresponding finite simple integrals. But in the limit towards F, these integrals could tend towards infinity. All right, but we don't want that. So what we demand is that if you look at all the four parts, positive real part, negative real part, positive imaginary part, negative imaginary part, that all four of those are finite. If all four parts are finite, which is equivalent to demanding that the integral of the absolute value of f be finite, then you just put those four things together. So the four terms are all unsigned integrals. Okay, so you have the positive part of the real part of f minus the negative part of the real part of f plus I times the positive part of the imaginary part of F minus I times the imaginary part, or minus I times the negative part of the imaginary part of F. Okay? Now, each of these is rigged, right, so that it produces a non-negative real number as the output, right? Like, so for example, 5 minus 7i, okay? The positive part of this is 5. Well, the positive part of the real part of it is 5. The negative part of the real part of it is 0. The imaginary part is negative 7. So the positive part of negative 7, right, is 0. On the other hand, the negative part of negative 7 is 7. Okay? So these four integrals are all unsigned integrals. Okay? So So this thing is just defined as this complex linear combination of four unsigned integrals. But this only works, we only use this definition if all four of these parts are finite. There's four unsigned integrals, and the output of each of these integrals could be a non-negative real number, or it could be positive infinity. If they're all finite, then it's unambiguous what we mean, right? If one of them was infinite and the other three were finite, then it would kind of make sense to define the integral as infinity in a particular direction, you know, in one of four directions on the complex plane. But it makes the theory uglier, so to speak. It's not as pretty. And if two of these are infinite, then it's really ambiguous what we're talking about, you know, especially if you have, you know, opposite directions, right? They're both infinite. So it's most fruitful to restrict yourself to the case where they're all finite. And all four parts are finite if and only if the following unsigned integral is finite. Where you take you take an x in D-dimension Euclidean space, plug it into f, you get a complex number, take the magnitude of that complex number. So then that's a non-negative real number. So if this is finite, then all four of these will be finite. And in fact, they'll all be less than or equal to this integral. Conversely, if all four of these are finite, then this integral will be at most the sum of those four. And this quantity here is defined to be the what's called the L1 norm of F. So think L for Lebesgue integral, and the 1 just represents the fact that we're just raising this absolute value to the power 1, whereas later, inside the Fourier transform, you would raise this magnitude to the power 2, and you'd have what's called the L2 theory. So, of course, you're thinking of magnitudes of complex numbers, right? You have the obvious thing. Okay. That's sort of the layout of the land. And the interesting stuff is that these things are... this unsigned integral definition, right, it's a supremum, a least upper bound. So that means that as far as these integrals are concerned, you can approximate your function very well by simple functions. And simple functions are made up of measurable sets. And measurable sets can be very well approximated by elementary sets. Therefore, you can actually approximate your function, or at least its integral, very well by an integral of a piecewise constant function. And then if you do a little bit more trickery, you can then approximate it very well by the integral of a continuous function. And that is one of Littlewood's principles, right? What are Littlewood's three principles? It was in the reading. One of them is that a function that is in L1, that is, if it has finite L1 norm, any function like this is approximately continuous.
Okay.
What I was saying about approximating by continuous functions only works if all of these coefficients here are finite.
That's one of the principles. Other principles. The other two principles are,
as I said before, every measurable set can be approximated by an elementary set. And then the third principle is that if you have pointwise convergence, then you can get an approximate form of uniform convergence. So. All three of the principles could be summarized as saying bad stuff happens, but not very often, right? It's that you can confine bad stuff to a set of very small measure. Okay. One of the strongest forms of that is Lucin's theorem, the end of subsection 1.3.3. Right? What does that say? You've got a function. And it says that if you throw away a set of arbitrarily small measure, you get your function to be continuous. What's the hypothesis on the function? Just that it's L1. Yeah, you'll see that a lot. That's just all the functions that are measurable, mapping to the complex plane, and their L1 norm, that is the integral of the magnitude of the function, is finite. For every epsilon greater than 0, there exists an E measurable subset Euclidean space such that what? Such that F is continuous outside of E and E is small. You have to be careful when you restrict to a set, what do you mean the function is continuous when restricted? So, i.e. or id est. In other words, or that is to say, for every U open subset of Euclidean space, there exists a open subset of Euclidean. Actually, let me get better. Okay, I start in the codomain. So for every open subset of complex plane, there's an open subset of Euclidean space such that one formulation of continuity is preimages of open sets are open. So to adapt that to taking away E, you work in what's called the subspace topology. So if you take any open subset of the complex plane, take its pre-image, then it needs to be open in the subspace topology, which means that it's equal to some open subset of Euclidean space intersected with this set. So take away E. Continuous in that sense. Now, you have to be careful, though, because actually this pre-image could have stuff that's in E, so you have to take that away, too. So the function may not be continuous, you know, on all of Euclidean space. So it may be that the pre-image of U is not open, but you can get it to be open up to an error of measure epsilon. Okay. A similar manifestation is the following, which is for any L1 function, there exists a G, which is continuous. Such that if you do the integral, unsigned integral now, of f minus g, right? So for any x, take the difference of f and g, take the magnitude of that complex number, and we can make this as small as we want. So for any positive epsilon, I can get this to be at most epsilon. Okay? So you could think of that as up to a kind of average error, so to speak. Not really average, but up to a... up to a integral error, kind of an error in area, if you're thinking of it as area under graph of curve. The function is continuous. If the two functions were, say, both equal to zero outside of some set of measure one, then you could really think of this as an average error. But since Euclidean space is infinite dimensional, I won't use the word average in that sense here. One way to think about it would be kind of take this and divide it by the L1 norm of F. And then you could make this a small fraction of that L1 norm as you want. So you could think of it, if the integral of the magnitude of f is, say, 11, then you could get a continuous function, right, such that the integrated difference between f and g was as small a fraction of 11 as you wanted. Various ways of saying that these things are very, very close to each other. See, the difference here is, like with this theorem, you have continuity except on some small set, but the function, as an unrestricted function, it might not be continuous anywhere. Right. because this set of exceptional points, although it could have really small measure, it could be, say, dense, like the set of all points with rational coordinates or something.
Okay. So let's talk about, how do we prove this one? So
the idea would just be approximate each of the four parts, right? Positive real, negative real, positive imaginary, negative imaginary. By a continuous function with, instead of epsilon over 4 error, right, have the error, or instead of epsilon error, epsilon over 4 error, right? And then the total error will add up to be at most epsilon. Right? Right? So now you just have to approximate an unsigned integral that has you're looking at an unsigned integral, you know it's going to be finite, and that means when you look at all these underestimates, right, from these kind of unsigned simple functions, all of the coefficients have to be finite. So let's say, let's just call H the positive real part. Now let's approximate it. And let's say that I is the integral, the big integral of H. So we're assuming F is an L1, so this integral I is finite. So finite, non-negative real. You do the same kind of argument for the other four parts of that. All right. So we can get as close to we want with underestimates, right? Because we define the Lebesgue integral as the supremum. So for any delta, no matter how small, we can find a simple function. Okay. So say something like this. Such that this integral is a simple integral where you just add up the areas of these rectangles, is at most a delta underestimate. And that this function is pointwise under f. Or h, the positive real part of f. So this thing will live in the interval from I minus delta to I, whatever that value is. Right? Now, how small do we need to make delta? Well, I'm not sure yet. Figure it out later. Okay. So that's the first thing. Approximate it by simple things.
Now, go back all the way back into, I think it's section 2 of 1.2, and look at exercise 1.2 point. Is it? Where to go? Yeah, I've lost. Yes, 1.2.16, for example. That's the you've got that a set with finite Lebesgue measure, differs from an elementary set of arbitrarily small Lebesgue outer measure. You see, each of these, this thing, these are all non-negative, and yet it comes out to be a finite real, right? Because I is less than infinity. Okay? So each of these sets must have finite measure, and each of these coefficients must be finite. Because otherwise this thing, if there's any infinities in here, then this sum would come out infinite. The only exception would be if you had infinity times zero or zero times infinity, which goes to zero. But you can assume that these are all non-zero, because if any of them are zero, then you could just throw them away without changing anything. So, if it, by convention, zero times infinity is zero, so we can throw away any terms that are zero without affecting, you know, the property of being under h, or the property of being simple and unsigned. Okay. So that means anything that remains will be positive and finite, because we know it doesn't add up to something infinite. Okay. So since each of these is finite, there exists an elementary. Okay, so that means finite union of boxes, right? Elementary, I guess we'll call it AN, equal to some finite union of boxes. AN plus AN minus EN has measure however small we want. So again, we could do for any delta, right, we could get this as small as we want. So the difference between the sets and measure is It's really small.
If you think of this as these two things as kind of the symmetric difference between the two sets.
So you can approximate it very well. And
if you think about what's going on here now, you've got think in the one-dimensional case, so that these are just finite unions of intervals. Okay. And so you're imagining now for each of these simple functions.
Yeah. Break out different colors now. Right. So
you have some kind of complicated set En, then it's well approximated by some finite union of intervals, a simple set An.
Okay. And now think about the integral itself.
Add up the areas of boxes, right? So you've got a Cn, right? So you have different boxes. So I should. Okay, so. Now with the En, it's not really a box, but you can think of it as some kind of cylinder, so to speak, right? Where the x coordinates consider all the x coordinates in En, and then consider all the lines, line segments on those x coordinates where y goes up from 0 to Cn. Okay, and what's the difference in area here? Right. Well, you'll have the value of Cn, okay, times this difference in the size of the x coordinates, okay. So this is kind of our. So now we started with simple function s. Now I have, I'll call it t, which will be a step function, right? Piecewise constant function, in other words. Now what's the difference between this, if you have this delta here, What's the L1 difference, right, between S and T? Right? It's just going to be the sum of all of these errors times all these errors in width, so to speak, times the heights. Okay. So in terms of the L1 norm, what is this going to be? I'm going to need a new board. Let's just do the new board. Kind of a three-step process here. Approximate the function from below by a simple function. And you can make the error of the integrals as small as you want that way. And then we approximate the simple function by a step function, that is a piecewise constant function. That's so.
Camera problem there. Left my external memory card at home, so I have to delete a bunch of pictures on the internal memory to make room. Memory for today's pictures. Summarize the situation. So for some delta that we'll choose, we'll figure out how small we need it to be later. We'll have that H, the positive real part of F, is at most delta off, right? When we approximate it by this simple function. And then what about now we approximate by a stepwise function? So, yeah. What's the error in going from simple to stepwise? So we're just going to have this sum of a bunch of widths here. Now, there's no reason. Like, for any delta, in the first step of the approximation, we can get it delta good. And then for any delta, we can get the second stage of the approximation delta good. So there's no reason I have to use the same delta. So, you know, I can call this, for any delta 1, right, in the first step, and then call the second step, you know, for any delta 2. I'm not going to artificially constrict, things. It might be that the argument is easiest just by allowing different deltas there. Okay, so this one, what is it going to be? We're going to have at most, this delta 2 width error times each of the cn's. So we chose the simple function. The simple function we choose, for a given delta, we may need to choose a different simple function. So this k here depends on delta 1. Okay. And so do all the coefficients cn, right? So let's remind ourselves of that. So what are we going to have here? We're going to have a sum of errors. Each error will be, at most, the delta 2, the width error for each part, times the height, cn. And we can get some kind of uniform control on this. Factor out the delta 2. And you get this thing least this is some finite number. And now finally, how do I approximate a step function by a continuous function? From you know, this kind of situation, yeah, I mean, really, you know, it could be anything, and it does. Just do something like this, you know. Make a kind of a, talk like a surgeon, make a tiny little incision here, and just remove a teensy bit, and remove a teensy bit here, teensy bit there, teensy bit there, and then just, okay? Now, when you do this, then what is the, if you take the L1 difference, right, it'll grab the area of this triangle, area of that triangle, build it. Right, because when you take the, when you do the L1 difference, you're integrating the magnitudes of the absolute value, the magnitudes of the differences, right? So it's not like these things cancel out. You have to pay for it, okay? But you can make these, right, as small as you want, right? Just by making them as narrow as you want, have this. Something like that. I mean, in terms of what is the actual error, well, now you'd have to look at, you know, all of these unions of boxes, right? So there's, but using this kind of maneuver, you can get a function g. And we're just looking at the positive real part. I guess for every delta 3 greater than 0, you get a g where you say make it that much. And so now here, how much are we going to pay? You're going to have these kinds of areas. So you're talking, you know, make them, if you make them say delta 3, then there's like two of them, and how bad can it be? Well, it depends on how high things get. And that's just from the heights are given by the CNs. Okay. So you can, if both of these were equally high, then you could imagine putting them together to make not quite a full rectangle. Maybe half of a rectangle of its height. So you have something like, geometrically it'd be about, I think it should be one half CN, but then, and that's not anything, that's some linguistic. Okay, so you have those, but then there's some number of intervals in your approximation here, right? So, if it's really bad, you know, you have to do something like this, right? But actually, it's just for each of them, so just however many there are, right? The point is, this is all finite, right? Now, of course, the PNs, right, the number of intervals involved with the approximation used to get T, I mean, that depends on delta 2. Okay. All right. And the point is, these are all, you know, finite. Finite. Okay. Okay. So, how can we make it all work in the end? Choose delta 1 at most epsilon over 12, say. Okay. Choose delta 2 at most
epsilon over 12 times the reciprocal, of this thing. And then finally, you choose delta 3 at most epsilon over 12 times the reciprocal of that thing. Then it all works out. Then by doing that, I have three errors of epsilon over 12 each, at most. So the total error will be, think of it as H minus S plus S minus T plus T minus G. Okay? Now, as proved in this section, 1.3.3, the L1 norm is subadditive. Right? So. So this, in the worst case where there's no cancellation at all, right, each of these three terms adds up. Okay? So for the positive real part, we found a continuous approximation in the sense of the integral being, in the sense of the integrated magnitudes of differences adding up to at most epsilon over 4. Now do likewise for the negative real part and the positive imaginary part and the negative imaginary part, and then put the four approximations together. And then the integrated magnitude of the difference between your function and your continuous approximating function will be at most epsilon. Okay. So you saw two of Littlewood's principles at work here. The first principle was that at least in one dimension, a set of finite Lebesgue measure is approximately a finite union of intervals, and in higher dimensions, it's approximately a finite union of boxes. That's this part. And then the second principle, which was that a measurable function in L1, so sometimes we call this absolutely integrable. You'll see that in the book. So a function where the four integrals of its four parts come out finite, such a measurable function is approximately continuous. And I gave two senses in which a function is approximately continuous. And I proved the second sense there. You may have read somewhere early in the book that the author does not include lots of pictures, but he strongly encourages you to make lots of pictures as you read along to make sense of it. Okay, so that's why I'm throwing pictures here and there at key points. Questions or comments about this example? Next up, we'll talk about Littlewood's third principle. But here's the list. In very heuristic form, right? Something in finite measure is approximately elementary, finite union of boxes. And second principle is if your function is, as they say, if it's measurable and the integral and the four integrals for its parts come out finite, then you have a continuous function. And then finally, point-wise convergence of a sequence of measurable functions is approximately, in a certain sense, equal to uniform. Same sequence of functions.
Now,
one thing to note is that if a function is a pointwise limit of measurable functions, then it itself is measurable. And in fact, you don't even need, if you throw away a set of measure zero, that it's still going to work, right? And you could, the exact same thing is true for complex valued functions.
Okay. These are exercises. Part 5 and 1.37 Part 2.
unsigned and complex valued versions of them. So, this is one of the ways in which the theory of Lebesgue measurability, Lebesgue integrability, it's much nicer than the theory of Riemann integration, because you can have a pointwise limit of functions that are each Riemann integrable, but the limit fails to be Riemann integrable. Or you can have a pointwise limit of continuous functions that fails to be continuous. But the measurable, the class of measurable functions, whether you're talking unsigned measurable or complex valued measurable, is a very robust class in the sense that it's very hard to get out, right? You take a sequence of points, and even if it only converges in this weak sense, right, of pointwise convergence, right, that's still not enough to escape the class. Right? So once you're in, it's hard to get out. And so there's Ergerov's theorem, which is one expression of Littlewood's third principle here. But let me add another note to this. If A is measurable and M star and you have a set B with outer measure 0, then actually B is measurable. Adding it or taking it away does not affect the measure of A, okay? In particular, its actual measure is 0, right? So anything with outer measure 0 is called a null set. And of course, any subset of a null set will then also have measure 0. So this notion of measure zero could include really, really complicated sets cooked up with the axiom of choice or some craziness, but they're small enough that their outer measure is zero. So it doesn't cause any problems. When you have crazy complicated sets that are not of zero outer measure, then you have problems. Okay. So the point here is the outer measure is zero, don't worry about it. and that's a lot of the way in which Littlewood's principles work is if something is of measure, epsilon, or even better, measure zero, then don't worry about it. We can get a good approximation. Okay. So let's say I have measurable functions. They don't even have to have they don't have to be in L1. The integrals of their four parts, they might be infinite. But if they're just measurable, okay, and I have some epsilon positive, and I guess one more thing, and they converge pointwise almost everywhere. Then there exists an A measurable subset
of Euclidean space, and I can make the measure small, and
now the next thing is a little bit technical. The outside of this kind of small bad set A, the functions converge, as they say, locally uniformly. Okay.
If I was writing it in, if I was trying to abbreviate it in I might abbreviate it a ton like this, right? But that little kind of half harpoon there means restrict too. But let me put a little Latin id s there and tell you that is to say, what is this locally uniform thing and restricted outside of the bad set A all mean? Okay, for every B, a bounded, that means it's a subset of some box, okay? For every B, bounded and avoiding A, so subset of the complement of A, and for every degree of precision, I already used epsilon, so I'll use delta. For every degree of precision, delta, okay, the convergence, basically the convergence is uniform on if you restrict any bounded set that avoids A. So that means that for every delta, there exists some big number n that does not depend on position in space. It works for every point in B. So for any term in the sequence after this term, and for any point in B, the difference between the nth term and this pointwise limit is less than delta, right? So instead of for each x, you know, if you wait long enough, you get delta f of n of x gets delta close to f of x. You have to, now you can say for any bounded set that avoids my small measure bad set, there's a delta that works for all the points in there at the same time. There's an n, a big n that works for all the points in there at the same time. N depends on delta, but not on where you are, right, in the set. It depends on B, it depends on delta, but it doesn't depend on X. And if you're wondering about the proof, you have to use the epsilon over 2 to the n trick. Right? And you can, of course, read the proof if you haven't already. And we're out of time.
Okay, so. So the homework I gave you was 1.3.18.